Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, The Independent, NewYorkTimes.com, ClassicRock.About.com, RollingStone.com, BGORecords.com, ClassicBands.com, and Entertainment Weekly. This opening number, How Am I Different?, is brought to us by the artist Amy Mann. We'll be hearing more about and from Amy Mann later on in today's program. But first, these trivia questions. Once again, our trivia questions are brought to us by Classic Rock's Fascinating Facts from ClassicRock.com. Question number one, Led Zeppelin has had every one of their albums reach the Billboard Top 10. Is that true or false? Let me give you a hint. Only one band has ever accomplished this feat. Question number two, Diana Ross has recorded 18 U.S. number one songs. How many Grammy Awards has she won? The answers to these two trivia questions will be given at the end of today's program. The transition section of today's program is brought to us once again by BGORecords.com, today in rock history. And today is April 17 and April 18. What were the number one hits on those dates? Well, back in 1965, it was Bob Dylan with Freewheeling. And back in 1971, the number one hit was Three Dog Night, Joy to the World This Weekend. And finally, in 1976, it was Vangelis, Chariots of Fire, number one hit on April 17 and 18. If you were born on April 17th, you share a birthday with Roy Ralph Estrada, Mothers of Invention. He was born on that day, back in 1943. And Bill Kreutzmann from the Grateful Dead, born on that day, back in 1946. Pete Shelley of the Buzzcocks, born in 1955 on April 17th, and Liz Phair, 1967, born on April 17th. And if you were born on April 18th, you share a B-Day with Glenn Hardin of the Crickets. He was born on that day in 1939. Mike Vickers of Manfred Mann. He was born on April 18th, 1942. Skip Spence of Moby Grape, 1946, April 18th, and Lenny Baker, Sha Na Na, born in 1946 on April 18th. Deaths on April 17th include Vince Taylor of Sha Na Na. He died on April 17th, 1974. And Linda McCartney died on April 17th, 1998. Miscellany in rock history this weekend. Well, back in 1955, it was Fats Domino. Ain't That a Shame, released in the U.S. And back in 1959, on this weekend, it was Ricky Nelson's It's Late, hitting the charts. Back in 1960, a year later on this date, Eddie Cochran dies and Gene Vincent is seriously injured when their car blows a tire and crashes in Great Britain. Back in 1964, this weekend, it was the Rolling Stone releasing their first LP in the U.K. Back in 1970, this weekend, it was Johnny Cash performing at the White House. And back in 1971, Janis Joplin's Pearl enters the UK LP chart. Back in 1971, this weekend, it was all four Beatles having solo singles on the UK charts. Paul McCartney, Another Day. Ringo Starr, It Don't Come Baby. John Lennon, Power to the People. And George Harrison, My Sweet Lord. Finally, back in 1980, this weekend, it was Bob Marley playing at Rhodesia Independence Day celebrations. This final transitions piece was reported in the NewsObserver.com back on April 9, 2010. Malcolm McLaren managed the Sex Pistols, London. The former manager of the Sex Pistols and one of the seminal figures of the punk rock era, Malcolm McLaren, died April 8th. his son said. He was 64. Joe Corey said his father died of an aggressive form of cancer while in Switzerland, declining to give the exact location. He was the original punk rocker and revolutionized the world, Corey told the Associated Press in a telephone interview. He's somebody I'm incredibly proud of. He's a real beacon of a man for people to look up to. McLaurin is best known for his work with the Pistols, whose violence, swearing, and anti-establishment antics shocked Britain and revolutionized the world music scene. The band's chaotic career owed much to their manager's talent for self-promotion. Without Malcolm McLaren, there would not have been any British punk, said music journalist John Savage, who wrote England's Dreaming, which chronicles the history of the group. But McLaren, an art school dropout, was first known for his fashion and the infamous clothes shop he opened on London's King Road with his girlfriend, Vivian Westwood, in 1971. The shop changed its name and focus several times, operating as Sex and World's End before Westwood and McLaren split, but its offbeat brand of clothing gave him a window onto the emergent punk music scene. It was McLaren who gave the name Sex Pistols to the group of young men hanging out at the store and helped pick out frontman John Lydon, soon known as Johnny Rotten. McLaren signed the group with EMI, and their first single, Anarchy in the UK, came out in 1976. The group would aggressively court controversy, becoming a household name after an expletive-packed appearance in a British television interview, which would see a ban on the group's live performances in the UK. After being dropped by EMI for bad behavior, the group later signed with Virgin. Their second single, God Save the Queen, whose title lyrics are followed by The Fascist Regime, was released during Elizabeth II's Silver Jubilee celebrations, an auditory assault on the monarchy, which sparked widespread outrage and saw members of the band attacked in the streets. The controversy was no impediment to the group's success, but the Sex Pistols fell apart during their U.S. tour, descending into acrimony and legal action. Their bassist, Sid Vicious, died of a heroin overdose in 1979 after he was accused of killing his girlfriend, Nancy Spungen, in New York City in 1978. Although the group had broken up after only one album, 1977's Nevermind the Bollocks, their rebellious antics and raucous music would set the bar for the bands to come. In local contemporary rock news, we see this article called Arctic Monkeys Keep the Attitude from newsandobserver.com, published by Ed Condren on the 2nd of April, 2010. The title of the Arctic Monkeys incendiary 2006 debut disc, Whatever People Say I Am, That's What I'm Not, offered a hint of what the British band is all about. The guitar-driven quartet came off as snide, contrarian teens during interviews and performances. They acted like rock stars out of the gate, and in fact, the Arctic Monkeys were that practically from the band's inception. Since the early demo circulated on the web as MP3s, more than 100,000 copies of Whatever People Say sold during its first week of release, making it one of the best-selling debuts ever. During the first American tour, the band possessed the swagger of English ancestors Oasis and the pop-rock precision of the Buzzcocks. Vocalist, guitarist Alex Turner packed the wit of Pulp's cerebral Jarvis Cocker. I really don't think we gave a damn, guitarist Jamie Cook said during a telephone interview from London. People either loved us or they didn't, and we couldn't give a toss. We just wanted to make the best music that we could. The songs The Rollicking View from the Afternoon, The Sensual I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor, and The Clever Marty Bum have a punk rock common denominator that hasn't changed. The Arctic Monkeys performed April 6th at Disco Rodeo in Raleigh and are still sonically adventurous. Their third album, Humbug, was produced by Josh Homme of Queens of Stone Age and Them Crooked Vultures. The key thing that Josh provided was a push, Cook said. He encouraged us to explore and take some chances, but to still be true to our sound. We might seem like we come from different worlds, but the connection between us and Queens of the Stone Age, who we love, is that both bands don't care about huge mass commercial appeal. That just doesn't matter to us. We didn't get into music to become these big stars. Arctic Monkeys, which include bassist Nick O'Malley and drummer Matt Helders, think their work has been validated now that the iconic Tom Jones has covered I Bet You Look Good on the Dance Floor. I'm a big fan of Tom Jones, Cook said. I thought that that was the coolest thing when I found out he was covering the song. It was like, we've officially made it. But really, when you add up that with working with Josh Homme and all the albums we've sold, we've done all right, especially considering that we're still pretty young. The cool thing is that we got here by being uncompromising. We just do what we want to do, which doesn't make us that different than when we first started. This next article was published in the Christian Science Monitor back on April 11, 2003, entitled Independence Day. What Record Industry Slump? Independent labels say business has never been better. 8 years ago, Nan Warshaw, Rob Miller, and their Chicago friends were lamenting the dearth of new and exciting music. Music that ignited their passion the way punk and alternative rock had before big record labels and Gap commercials co-opted their sounds. Then they began noticing that several area bands were putting Hank Williams twists on their Nirvana and Elvis Costello influences. So they decided, for kicks, to put out a compilation album of insurgent country. Warshaw and Miller anteed up a few grand apiece. We had no expectation that this was going to become a business, Ms. Warshaw says. The first few years we'd put out a record, and when it broke even we'd say, oh, what record should we do next? But 3.5 years after it first started, Bloodshot Records finally hired its first paid employee. Today it's a popular and healthy independent label, one of many operating outside the grip of the five mega majors, Sony Musical Entertainment Incorporated, Universal Music Group, BMG Entertainment, EMI Group, and Warner Music Group. While executives at those labels wail about the industry's imminent collapse, indie labels and artists are singing a much happier tune. Profits are up, in some cases by 50 to 100%. That's in contrast to overall album sales, which dropped about 11% in 2002. We don't do too much crying over here, Cameron Strang, founder of New West Records, admits proudly. The home of artists like Delbert McClinton, the Flatlanders, and John Hyatt has doubled its business for the past 3 years and is projecting a $10 million income in 2003. Paul Foley, general manager of the biggest independent label, Rounder Records of Cambridge, Massachusetts, happily brags 2002 was actually Rounder's best year in history. We were up 50% over 2001. You won't hear many of these labels' artists on pop radio, and ironically, that's one of the secrets of their success. By avoiding the major expenses associated with getting a tune on the air, which can cost upwards of $400,000 or $500,000 per song, independent labels are able to turn a profit far more quickly and share more of those profits with their artists. Another secret of their success is that the labels target consumers, namely adults, who are still willing to pay for their music rather than download it for free. Other artists, such as Amy Mann, who opened today's program, by the way, and Michelle Schacht, are going even further, forming their own labels so they don't have to answer to anybody. At a major label, most artists are unlikely to earn anything unless they sell at least 1 million albums, and even then they could wind up in debt. Everything from studio time to limo rides are charged against their royalties, which might be only $1 per disc sold. That compares with an indie artist who can sell a disc for $15 at a concert. If they make $5 profit a disc on 5,000 discs, they pocket $25,000. That's the difference between us and them, Mr. Strange said. Artists on our label who sell 200,000 copies make a very good living. Independents also pay profits only after recouping expenses, but they keep those down by curbing marketing and overhead costs. They also have more equitable arrangements, with artists often sharing profits 50-50. But perhaps the biggest difference is that they let artists keep the rights to their work. Michael Hausman, who manages Amy Mann, says once the large labels get those rights, they may choose not to release a note of the music, but won't let the artist work for anyone else, essentially bringing career momentum to a halt. Loved, then discarded. When rock critic and author Dave Marr spoke on a panel at last month's South by Southwest Music Conference in Austin, Texas, he pronounced bigger label contracts a bad deal for artists from day one because of unequal leverage. John Doe, who gained fame with then-wife Exene Cervenka in the 80s punk band X, says majors pump artist expectations to unrealistic levels. With majors, your visibility is much higher, but it's for a much shorter period of time, he explains. I feel bad for today's bands because they're loved and then they're discarded. Doe, now on Artist Direct iMusic imprint, also says there's no word to appropriately describe the meddling of major label A&R people whose job is to hear a hit on each album. I personally wouldn't like to be told what kind of album to make, Doe comments. Most indie labels pick up already recorded albums or give artists creative freedom to make the music they want. The article skips down. Self-described folk singer Annie DeFranco is the poster child for the do-it-yourself label movement. Her successful Righteous Babe Records has helped inspire artists Amy Mann, Jonathan Brook, and scores of others to go it alone. But unlike DeFranco, most choose that route after miserable major label experiences or a lack of offers. Article skips down and ends with, Brook and Mann spent time in their own label purgatories before giving up on the system. After starting her own label, Bad Dog Records, Brook also confessed, I gotta say, I'm the most fulfilled and content I've ever been. With the ease of internet sales and new support systems, such as United Musicians, an organization formed by Mann, her husband Michael Penn, and their manager Michael Hausman, to provide support services to indie artists, bucking the system truly seems like a smarter option than joining it. This next article was published RollingStone.com, April 1, 2010. April Fool's Rock Hoaxes, Bieber or Die, Coldplay, Perfume, and more. This was written by Daniel Kreps. April 1st is a rough day to be in the news business. Rolling Stone could get a press release that says Dr. Dre's detox finally has a release date, or Talking Heads are reuniting, or the Beatles are coming to iTunes, and we wouldn't believe it since so many folks use April Fool's Day to engage in shenanigans with their fans. Last year, Nine Inch Nails' Trent Reznor pretended he recorded an album with Timbaland, and Bjork announced she'd join Led Zeppelin, and in 2010, many artists are keeping the hoaxing tradition alive. Coldplay announced this morning that they were entering the lucrative perfume market with a fragrance called Angst. This is something we've wanted to do for a long time, Chris Martin jokes on the band's website. People like to smell nice, and we thought we could help them out. The fragrance, priced at £42 and packaged in a bottle designed by producer Brian Eno, is conveniently sold out in the band's online shop. Elsewhere on the web, current Billboard 2000 King Justin Bieber claims he's taken over humor site Funny or Die, renaming it Bieber or Die. Over on Twitter, Joe Jonas has announced he's going to space camp. John Mayer proclaimed he was starting a gold prospecting company called Golden Retrievers. And Paramore's Hayley Williams says, today, I'm going to punch a baby. Neil Diamond's verified Twitter account alerted fans, wow, just heard I finally got nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So either Diamond's messing with fans or someone's messing with Diamond. It's not just musicians having fun. Music sites and fan sites alike are pulling their readers' legs as well. Last night, 1:30 BPM announced that the Smiths were reuniting, and Consequence of Sound brought news of a new Vanilla Ice album called WTF. At least we hope this is an April Fool's gag. The article skips down and ends with, "We could go on and on, but we're still stinging from College Humor's prank that tricked us into thinking In-N-Out Burger is coming to New York." So who is this featured artist for today, Amy Mann? Well, this article from 2004's The New Rolling Stone Album Guide by Mac Randall gives this biography of Amy Mann. Intelligent, tuneful, and loaded with attitude, many of Amy Mann's songs should be instant pop classics. The only problem is that most of them haven't been very popular. Mann's understandable frustration at this and other hardships has come out increasingly in her music over the years, to the point where it's often tough to tell whether the guys she's venomously kissing off in song are ex-lovers or record company executives. And yet, tart as her lyrics may be, her melodies, expertly crafted pieces of retro chic that pay homage to all the usual 60s and 70s touchstones, never lose their sugar. Whatever. Mann's first album, following the dissolution of her 80s band Till Tuesday, is a veritable encyclopedia of regret, bitterness, and defeat set to glorious Beatles-worthy music. Highlights include the rousing rocker I Should Have Known and the woman meets much, much older man vignette, Mr. Harris, which manages to be both funny and touching. I'm With Stupid is rougher and less compelling, with a few ear-catching exceptions, Amateur, You Could Make a Killing, and All Over Now. After shuttling from one bad major label experience to another, Mann finally caught a commercial break with the soundtrack to Paul Thomas Anderson's film Magnolia. Although the album isn't completely hers, 4 of the 13 tracks are by other artists, including 2 by Supertramp. The stuff she's responsible for is some of her finest work, especially the cheeky stroll through Harry Nilsson's One and the beautifully somber Built That Wall. 3 Magnolia songs reappear on Bachelor No. 2, another outstanding disc that would be worth the list price for the poignant Ghost World alone. From the vintage Chamberlain tones of This Is How It Goes to the finely wrought metaphors of The Moth, nothing on Lost in Space will surprise fans of Mann's earlier albums, but nothing on it will turn them off either. Clearly, she's found a good sound, and she's sticking with it. Ultimate Collection, compiled by Mann's former record company to cash in on her Magnolia success, cobbles together a few nifty B-sides and 3 Till Tuesday cuts, including the band's biggest hit, 1985's Voices Carry, to bulk up the obvious choices from Whatever and I'm With Stupid. It's an okay intro to Mann's catalog, but the original albums are better. Amy Mann, by the way, has now recorded 7 total albums from 1993 to 2008. So let's take a listen to some Amy Mann. This first track is called Nothing Is Good Enough.
What was started out with such excitement, now I'd gladly end with really. And what now has become a familiar motif.
Now we'll hear Red Vines, a snippet from that.
They're all still on their honeymoon. Just read the dialogue below. Everyone
now we'll listen to a snippet from Driving Sideways. Once again, AB Mann will close out today's program with Calling It Quits. But first, this article. These contemporary rock reviews are printed in the Entertainment Weekly issue, 16th of April, 2010. Jeff Beck, who, by the way, is providing our interlude music today. Emotion and commotion. There aren't many musical avenues Beck has left unexplored, but Soporific, Muzak is one. Alas, the guitar legend ticks that box here with laid-back instrumental versions of Somewhere Over the Rainbow and Nissan Dorma that recreate the excitement of an elevator ride. Much better is Josh Stone featuring I Put a Spell on You, on which Bex proves that his way with a gutsy rock solo has been unaffected by the passage of time. This review by Clark Collis is given a C, and he says, download these, I Put a Spell on You, and Hammerhead. This next review is provided by Melissa Mayers in that same Entertainment Weekly magazine. Freelance Whales, Weather Vanes. Still holding your breath for the next Postal Service album? Listen to this instead. It's the best electronic indie pop debut since Ben Gibbard's last tuned his laptop. Armed with dreamy melodies, charmingly terrible pickup lines, and a vibrant band geek orchestra carting harmoniums and glockenspiels, this New York quintet makes tender-hearted nerdiness sound like a powerful strength. Given an A-minus, and she says, download these, Generator, First Floor, and Broken Horse. So how'd you do on the trivia questions? Led Zeppelin has had every one of their albums reach the Billboard Top 10, true or false? True. Led Zeppelin is, in fact, the only band to have had every one of their albums reach the Billboard Top 10. Second question, Diana Ross has recorded 18 U.S. number one songs. How many Grammys has she won? Zero. Diana Ross may have recorded 18 number one songs, but she's never won a Grammy Award. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until...
I'll do flips and get paid in chips from the dime.